support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway.
What is it you want, Barry? What do you want? You want the moon? Just say the word and I'll throw a lasso around it and pull it down.
Back in 1946, 5-year-old Jimmy Hawkins played the role of Tommy in It's a Wonderful Life. Decades later, the film was voted the most inspirational movie of all time by the American Film Institute. But when it hit the silver screen for the Christmas season in 1946, it was a box office flop and lost $500,000, even though it was nominated for 5 Academy Awards, including Best Picture. By pure happenstance, I was introduced to Jimmy Hawkins at a St. Vincent de Paul summer camp for disadvantaged kids in the hills above Santa Barbara. Come along and join Jimmy Hawkins as he recalls his role as Tommy, insights about Frank Capra, Jimmy Stewart, Donna Reed, and other cast members. He also talks about his subsequent roles as a teen heartthrob on the Donna Reed Show for 8 seasons. Hawkins starred in the first Elvis movie, Girl Happy, and his subsequent work as a producer. During the course of his career, Hawkins starred in or produced more than 500 movies and TV shows. Hawkins also shares the secret of the belated success and eventual cult-like love of It's a Wonderful Life that didn't take off until the 1970s when someone forgot to renew the copyright.
Look, Daddy, teacher says every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings.
That's right. That's right.
Jimmy Hawkins, what a pleasure to meet you. I was tipped off that you were Tommy in a movie.
Yes, I had the pleasure of being in a movie called It's a Wonderful Life, which was voted the most inspirational movie of all time by the AFI, American Film Institute. And every Christmas they show it, and it seems to get bigger and bigger. Every Christmas more people are aware of it, and people ask me all the time, why do you think the movie is so popular? Why do people gravitate to it? And I tell them I think it's the message of the movie, and they get to see that each man's life touches so many others. If they weren't around, it would leave an awful hole. And it gives them some hope that they're here for a reason and that they can touch lives if they choose for the better. And if they were taken out of the equation, things wouldn't be the same. And that's what people like about it. It's a Wonderful Life, and of course the great cast that Frank Capra put together with Jimmy Stewart and Donna Reed, just all the people.
It really was a perfect cast, wasn't it?
It was. It was impeccable.
Can't imagine a change
out. Anybody else in those parts.
Yeah, and I think we all agree that Jimmy was the keystone.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. And the thing is that it was the first movie he did after being in World War II for 4 years. And same with Frank Capra. And they were very nervous. They wondered if they still had it. Jimmy Stewart even told Lionel Barrymore, who played Old Man Potter, he told him that he thinks he's going to quit acting, that after being in World War II and seeing real life, that he just doesn't feel that this means anything. And Lionel Barrymore says, you're wrong. He says, you have a great gift. You can speak to people in the dark for 2 hours, and they'll listen to what you have to say. No, no, no. Acting's a great profession. You have a great gift for it. You stay right where you are. And it really made Jimmy Stewart feel better about himself while he continued to play this, which turned out to be an iconic role. You know, he was the quintessential common man, everyday guy.
Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, yeah. Another. Yeah.
That's right. He just was that guy. Mm-hmm. And Capra realized it, and it was his only choice for the part.
When the movie came out, was it an immediate hit?
No. It lost $500,000. It was up for 5 Academy Awards. The Academy recognized that there were great performances, great director, writer, the look of the movie. But it just didn't find an audience. After World War II, people were looking for other types of film.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes. I talked to Sheldon Leonard, who played Nick the bartender in the film, and he said the film never changed. The people did. And now the people realize that they need that message more than ever now. It just keeps growing. Mm-hmm. I don't go any place that when they find out that I was associated and played the youngest Bailey kid, they just can't believe somebody's alive from the movie. But it found its audience.
What do you remember of the filming? Do you remember being on the set?
Oh, yeah, I remember everything.
Really?
It's kind of funny. I've had just a terrific career as an actor in the motion picture business. And to be associated with that, I've done over 500 movies and TV shows, and It's a Wonderful Life just rose to the top. I don't care how long I was on different series or co-star of Elvis and did all the major TV shows. That is the one everybody wants to know about, gravitates to. Sure, they like to hear, well, how was Elvis? How was Ricky Nelson? How was Donna Reed? Because I was reunited with Donna Reed on the Donna Reed Show. I did the very first episode, and 8 years later, I was still doing the show. So I got to be very close with her. I sat on the board of her foundation for 25 years. And
she is much of a sweetheart as she appeared to be.
Better.
Really?
You know, it was her show. She really was the producer. She had all control, never exercised any displeasure in front of anybody. But it was a great running set. It was fun, a lot of humor. Nobody was, thinking they were making Gone with the Wind or anything.
Right, right.
But she was a real, very nice lady.
A memorable person and interaction on your time in Hollywood.
Oh, yeah, she was. You know, won the Academy Award From Here to Eternity. Her Donna Reed series lasted 8 seasons, quite a run. But deservingly, just worked very hard and for the show and showing women in different roles. And then got into her politics about mothers against war. Thought they should have different things, the way they could run things. Secretary of War, why can't they have a Secretary of Peace, she wondered. So, nice lady.
Let's go back in time to Tommy. It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
Tell us about some of the things that you remember.
I remember getting up real early in the morning. I'm 4 and a half years of age. You know, the half a year was a big deal at 4.
Yeah, right. 4 3/4.
Yeah. Yes, right. So I took buses and streetcars through L.A. out to Culver City, where they shot the film.
You were with your mom?
Yeah, It's right after World War II. I remember coming on the stage, huge stage, and the Bailey home was there. And there was real snow that they had outside of the home on the set. And I thought that was interesting. Walk on the set, there's that Christmas tree. And then I'd be with my siblings. We'd go to makeup, but, kids didn't really need that much makeup back then. They liked more natural look. And then we'd have a school teacher, welfare worker on the set, so that 3 hours would be dedicated to schooling. And then when they needed us on the set, we'd rehearse. Now, I have a line that's become very popular where I pull on Jimmy Stewart's coattails and I keep saying, excuse me.
What's the matter with our car? Isn't it good enough for you?
Steady. Excuse me.
Excuse you for what?
I burped. Now go on upstairs and see if it'll do what.
Excuse me. And then he's really ticked off. He finds out that he's lost $8,000. It's bankruptcy. It's shame, everything. He's got all this going on in his mind. And he says, excuse you for what? And I said, I burped. Well, this is a line that was not in the script. Frank Capra, when we were coming out of the living room going to the kitchen, he rehearsed everybody and we started walking. And then he said, okay, everybody stop. So then he'd squat down, talk to me one-on-one. He said, see where we are right now? See this spot we're in? Everybody's standing there. When you get here, I want you to pull on your daddy. That man is pretending he's your daddy. Pull on his coattails and say, excuse me, when you get right here on this spot. Do you understand that now? I said, yes, sir. He said, okay, everybody, let's go. So they started their dialogue. He said, everybody, stop. He said, you see where we are? Scrunch down again and squat down and talk to me face to face. You see where we are here now? We were over there. He said, excuse me. Now we're here. When you get to this spot, keep pulling on his coattail. Say, excuse me again. Got that? Oh, yeah.
Did they have literal marks?
Not in long shots, just close-ups. So you, as an actor, get used to that. Because then there's a key light for you. So we shot the scene. Rehearsed it a couple more times, all in one motion. And he said, okay, we're ready to shoot it. And shot it and did it. And I said to him years later, I said, you know, when we shot that, I said, what was the most difficult scene in the movie? He said, that scene with all you kids, with your older brother asking, how do you spell this? The girl, your sister pounding on the piano. You, excuse me. And he said, all that could be funny. And this is a serious scene with humor in it, but you couldn't have the people laughing at you. They had to laugh with you. And he said that was the most difficult to stage. I said, oh, that's interesting. I said, but I missed one of the excuse me's that you asked me to do. Why did you print it? He said, because it seemed natural, and I liked the way it was. I said, oh, okay.
Talk to us a little bit about Frank Capra. What a bigger-than-life character in Hollywood history.
Oh, yeah. He just knew what he was doing. He could tap dance, which means, I'll tell you, for instance, he was looking for locations for the movie. And they took him over to Beverly Hills High School in their gymnasium to shoot the scene where they're Charleston dancing and everything. And he meets Donna Reed as an older girl now, 18. He's looking over the place, and the AD came up to him. He said, Frank, do you know under this basketball court is a swimming pool? He said, what? He said, yeah, there's a swimming pool under. He said, well, open it up. Let's see. So they told him, open it up. He saw that, and that's where he wrote the whole scene about them dancing and falling into the pool. You know, it wasn't written. It just happened, and he took advantage of things like that. Not, gee, it's too bad. We could have a scene. Well, no. They're going to be a scene. That's going to cap this thing off where they fall in the pool together. And he just was very sharp. The excuse me line, that was a family joke in his own personal family. One of his youngest kids would always do that. Oh, excuse me, well, okay, now we say excuse you for what? I burped and the family laughed. So he put that in the movie. The night before, he said, I think I'll have the Tommy Bailey character say that. It just happened. Just he could see what was happening and then adjust to it.
And I think that you hit it on the head as a metaphor for you in that in the movie, there is that relaxed and believable element of all the actors and actresses.
Right. And the people say, well, did you know that this movie was going to do what it did? No. It was another day's work for all those actors you saw on it. They appreciated it. They loved it. They loved working with Capra and Jimmy Stewart, blending there, Bert the Cop or the taxi driver.
Oh, he was a great character.
Oh, yeah. Frank Phelan, nice people. You get to know him and working with him in later years.
The uncle that had
Uncle
Bert.
Billy.
Yeah,
Uncle
tell
Billy.
He was so lovable.
Oh, yeah. Well, he was, I mean, just a great actor from Gone with the Wind. I mean, whenever they needed a good actor. And Capra knew them all, and he knew where they would be best. Henry Travers as Clarence the Angel. You can't think of anybody else. You know, he saw his casting list, but, you know, he just had that touch. I can't imagine how disappointing that film was, his first film with his own company, with his partners. And his partner had another film to direct. And they both started the films off on the same day and both sent each other's telegram. One was doing It's a Wonderful Life, and the other was doing The Best Years of Our Life. And they were both up for the Best Picture. You know, it was just, and they hear partners on other projects.
Interesting. And it's just incredible, like you said earlier, that it was a flop financially.
It was. And it just fell in. Somebody forgot to pick up the copyright in the 70s. And then it became public domain. And that means TV stations all over the United States could play it for free. And they did. They could charge for it.
And they do.
Yeah. So it was a fluke that it fell in and then found its audience. And people started having It's a Wonderful Life parties. They had trivia games. It just grew and grew and grew. And it's such a thing to watch. It's a Wonderful Life has taken me places. I rang the bell at the Stock Exchange in New York.
When did you do that?
It was about maybe eight, nine years ago.
Oh, cool.
And, yeah, you see all these high rollers, and they couldn't believe that the Bailey kids were on that podium with the president of the New York Stock Exchange ringing that bell. It was great to push that button. It was great. It's just, that's what's fun about it. Places that you never thought you'd ever go.
Back to Elvis.
Well, like all actors, we go on interviews, And I was known for being the boyfriend of, you know, every girl on television. 3 years on Petticoat Junction. I did the Leave It to Beaver, Ozzie and Harriet, of course. 8 years on Donna Reed. And my three sons. So I was known for playing the boyfriend. So they got a call, and they wanted to see me out at MGM for an Elvis movie. So I was sitting there talking to the director and the producer, Joe Pasternak, and in the casting place that I had been since I was 2 years old. MGM did films with Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn. And
so you literally grew up in Hollywood then?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Were your parents involved?
No, my mom's father was one of the original Keystone Cops.
Oh, wow.
And so she just always wanted her kids in the picture business. My brother was in it before I was, and then I'd follow up. And so I was sitting there, you know, talking about, you know, how you do on interviews with the director. And all of a sudden the producer turned to me, Joe Pasternak, and he said, "Were you on Petticoat Junction last week?" I said, "Well, yes, I was." He turned to the room. He said, "He can play anything. Just explain to him what the parts are. He'll tell you who he's right for." And he said, "Okay, we'll be calling you to set up a meeting with the director. And, you know, thank you for coming in." Came in a week later. The director explained Elvis had three sidekicks in a band. And he explained to me which the three were. I told him, "Well, I think I'd be best for this part." "Okay." So they had signed me first for the picture, and I thought,
which picture was this?
This the first Elvis movie is Girl Happy. Then I did Spin Out with him afterwards. But the main thing, it got me into older roles.
You're no longer the teenage boyfriend.
Right. Yeah. And I said, now, if I think I can be Elvis's friend, that means that they're thinking of me as being a little older.
Was Elvis approachable? Were you ever able to hang out with him and talk to him?
Yeah, Shelley Fabre was the leading lady in the film. And, of course, I was her boyfriend for 8 years on the Donna Reed Show. She was my girlfriend when I was under contract to Gene Autry to do the Annie Oakley series. And so I'd known Shelley since we were kids. Now, she's playing his leading lady, and I'm his sidekick. And so we'd kind of hang out, and then we both would talk about, "Can you believe this? I mean, here we are with Elvis. Wow." And all of a sudden, we were sitting in my dressing room, and the door knocked on the door, these portable dressing rooms they have on the stage. They don't want the actors leaving, you know. They know, give them a dressing room. So we both look up, and it's Elvis. No entourage, no anything.
Just walks in.
Just, yeah. He said, "Can I join you?" "Yeah." I look at Shelley. Wow. So, you know, he sat there until we were needed for the next shot and just talked and talked and talked. And he was always doing that after weekends. He would take karate lessons on the weekends. Then he'd show us his newest movements. "What do you think of this?" And very approachable, very nice, very humble. Wasn't, you know, "I'm Elvis, you're nobody." He was just a very, very nice person. It's just sad the way it ended.
Yeah.
Because he was a nice person.
Who were some of the other actors and actresses that touched you?
Well, for me, I did one of the very first family shows on television in the late 40s. I did that for 3.5 years with a actor by the name of Charlie Ruggles. Now, he was a big star in the 30s and 40s, big movie star. And he came to television, and they had a situation comedy. Family. I played one of twins, had an older brother and sister, of course a mom, and we did that live for ABC. That was on the ABC network, and it was live. And we do it once for LA, once for New York at 4:30, say, then we'd all break for dinner, get little notes and stuff, and then go to dinner. And then it's like 7:30, we'd do it for West Coast. So that lasted for 3.5 years. Like I said, then I was off about 6 weeks, and Gene Autry was looking for a Tag Oakley in the Annie Oakley series. And he signed me, and I was doing that show for 6 years, which was great because I get to go on tour to state and county fairs. I would travel with Gene Autry and be a special guest. He looked at it as he got the older audience, and then Annie Oakley series got the younger audience with Tag Oakley. Just a great experience. Gene Autry I learned a lot from. Charlie Ruggles about acting and don't stop. This is a live show. You can't stop. Remember that. Just keep talking.
Was that a lot of pressure for you?
No, it was just the way it was. See, I wasn't aware. It's like, oh, now this is live. It's going out to millions of people. No, no. It's just show. You're an actor. This is the part. Okay. Now, did I break up sometimes? Yes. The little girl and I that played my twin, we'd look and then we'd break up. And we were doing a commercial for the show. Or, you know, oh, my God. It was a great experience. Great. Live. Then, when Annie Oakley was over, I started doing the Don Reed Show.
You were very relaxed throughout your career, even as a kid. You don't sound like you were ever pressured or stressed.
No, I was very lucky because, you know, that's you're hired to do a job, and my parents would tell me this is the job, and when the man, the director, tells you what to do, you do what he tells you on the set. And if you ever become a wise guy, you know, smart aleck, mm-hmm. will just take you out, and you won't be doing this anymore. And I understood the rules, and they were concerned parents. A lot of people act, oh, you know, I hear some kid actors do this, they're not happy, they kill themselves, they commit suicide, whatever. Well, why were you the way you were? I said, it's your parents. You look right over the shoulder of the kid, and there's the problem. Or no problem. It was no problem for me, because I just worked all the time.
When you watch the movie now, do you time travel in moments when you're watching, when you see yourself?
For some reason, I don't know why, I could always take myself and then look at that actor. It wasn't me.
Yeah, it was somebody else, yeah.
It was somebody else, and I would go, oh, I should have waited a little longer to say that word. And that's how I learned. Watched. Somebody else may not know it, but it was honing. No, no. Say it a little slower or think about it a second longer, whatever, all those things. I could look. I wasn't. And I have actor friends. I became a producer in later life.
That's what I was going to ask her. So you're not acting now?
No, huh? And I started producing movies.
And why did you shift?
I was burnt out as an actor.
You're done.
I wasn't a great actor. I was great at doing a certain thing. And I capitalized on it. You remember a series of movies Mickey Rooney did called Andy Hardy?
Sure.
Well, MGM made it a TV series, and I was Andy Hardy. So that was my favorite studio. My parents used to call it MGM, not MGM.
MGimmy.
MGM, yes.
Yeah, so, I love it.
Yeah, so I just got burnt out, and mm-hmm. I wondered what it would be like to get an idea and then see it on the screen and what all it takes.
And do you pull that off?
Oh, many times now, yeah. The first one, I quit acting, and then I started looking around for projects, and then I had a lunch with a friend of mine out at Universal, and I said, well, what are you doing here? He said, well, I'm working with George Hamilton on a movie. We're trying to raise the money. I said, well, what is it? She said, oh, it's called Evel Knievel. I said, what's that? He said, well, this guy jumps his motorcycle over cars and stuff. And I said, really? That sounds interesting. He said, why don't you come out to the house tonight and Betty will fix us dinner and I'll tell you more about it. Okay. So he did. I said, no, so what are you doing now with it? We're trying to get the money. I said, I can get the money for that picture. He said, really? I said, yeah. He said, oh, well, let me talk to George. I said, yeah, I want you to talk to him in case somebody's asking. And then they go, well, who's this guy? He's trying to sell your movie. He said, oh, no, I'll take care of that. So I sent it to three people. One person said, I like it, but I don't want George Hamilton. I said, well, it's his project. it's his. You take him. He's going to play evil. Well, no, I'm not interested. Two other people were interested, and I finally got the guy to come up with $750,000 to produce this movie. We shot it in like 20-some-odd days.
Wow.
And it opened at the Grauman's Chinese Theater. And the lines were around the block. It was incredible.
You must have loved that.
I went, wow. Because that's what I always wanted to do. I wanted to see getting an idea that was nothing. It wasn't a script or anything. It was just an idea about some guy that jumps a motorcycle. And then to sit in the Grauman's Chinese Theater and see this thing. It was just a wonderful experience. That's the greatest part of it, is it got done, you know?
And another movie that you worked on.
Oh, I did the Satchel Paige story. He was one of the greatest baseball pitchers that ever lived. However, he pitched at a time when blacks couldn't play with whites. And it was the story of his frustrations of knowing he was better. Dizzy Dean said, he's the greatest pitcher I've ever seen, yet you can't play with the big boys, you know? And then the story evolves, and you see how he pitched the Cleveland Indians into the World Series and then pitched in the World Series.
That's so cool. You must have gotten really close to Satchel Paige throughout that process,
Yeah, he was a very nice guy, very... He tells me a story because I asked him, I said, let me ask you something, Satchel. How did you get the name Satchel? He said, oh, well, I used to be in the outfield, and I had this satchel with me, and they hit all these balls out, and I'd pick them up, put them in the satchel, and then run back to, you know, drop the balls and go back again. I said, oh, really? He said, I used to have a big pole and work at the train depot, and when people step off the train, I'd say, let me take your bag, and I'd have this long pole with a lot of different bags on it. So I'd make a lot of more money with not as many trips. I said, well, which one was it? He said, which one do you like the best? That's the way he was.
I love it.
Yeah, he's just a very, very nice guy, very inventive. And, of course, Lou Gossett played him in our movie.
And, which was a great character role.
Oh, yeah, just great. So, you know, I did the story of the first C&I dog, Disney movie I set, sold to Disney. It was a story of how the C&I got into America, how the laws had to be changed to allow dogs in. And it was...
You know what's cool about your journey is that you learned, you were like going to school forever. You learned so many cool things.
Yeah, I really am. Met great people.
And no desire to do any more acting?
None whatsoever. No, I did it. And it was great. And the time we did it, it was fabulous. And just met Fred McMurray. All these great stars, worked one-on-one with them, and they would always call me back. So I said, well, I must like what I'm doing. That's nice. So I've just had a wonderful life myself, a great career, and here I get to talk with you and share stories, and well, I like that.
Well, I love it, too, because like a lot of people that you know, you've been a part of my life for my whole life, but I never got to meet Tommy, so
that's
pretty
nice
cool.
You to say, yeah. I get to meet you, so works both ways.
It does. Jimmy Hawkins, thank you so much. What a wonderful day.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Thank you. Wonderful life.
To be here at this camp for St. Vincent de Paul and see what they're doing. Want to see what if I can join forces with them and help put wonderful in their organization.
I know they'd be honored, totally.
It'd be my honor to be able to help these kids and see where these kids come from, broken homes, foster homes, and to be able to come here and enjoy a week thanks to the gratitude and generosity of people with a lot of money.
Jimmy Hawkins, thanks again.
Okay, best to your time.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. Support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway. With a focus on rural communities, such as Leaper's Fork, not far from Nashville, the Big Backyard journey traverses through Tennessee's southwest quarter down into Alabama's legendary Shoals region, the mothership of American music. The featured rural community's common thread is historic architecture and a timeless, charming small-town atmosphere, some with a river running through it. The diverse attractions of the featured communities include the amazing Elephant Sanctuary in Hohenwald, where retired circus elephants come to retire in peace, and iconic destinations like Northern Alabama's Shoals region, where you'll find one of America's most iconic Frank Lloyd Wright homes and two of America's legendary recording studios that have been etching American soundtracks since the early 1960s. For example, Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, opened in 1969, instantly started marking up the charts with number one hits by recording artists like the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, Wilson Pickett, Linda Ronstadt, Rod Stewart, and Paul Simon. Nashville's Big Backyard's ardent promoters include Mike Wolf, host of History Channel's American Pickers TV series, who provides a surgical contextual lens focused on Nashville's Big Backyard's diverse initiatives, and Liz McLaurin, president of the Land Trust for Tennessee, an equally passionate supporter of Nashville's Big Backyard's greater good elements through the Land Trust Preservation Initiatives. To learn more about the program, log on to nashvillesbigbackyard.org.
Actually, that's all I listen to is NPR.
Nice.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.